You're listening to the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast hosted by Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, and Brad Tarver. Well, I guess not much happened this week, right? Pretty slow week news-wise. Let's just dig in with what some of the things we've missed over the last few weeks. One of the things that we didn't talk about when it happened was Apple abandoned its car plans for now, and they're saying that in late 2017, they're going to decide if they're going to do a self-driving system of some sort. Surprisingly, we had a lot to talk about with the new products. This just sort of fell under our radar.
Well, you really need more than just a bunch of smart guys in a big building to put together a car. I mean, you need huge infrastructure, huge manufacturing, a ton of engineers. It's not something that they're really going to be prepared to do.
I think Apple has a ton of cash on hand, and if they want to play around with stuff like this, it's just fine. If they end up shelving it, then it's probably meant to be shelved. You know, eventually they're going to stumble upon something that's the next iPhone, the next iPad, and they'll stick with it. So I think this is one of those things that somebody there saw an opportunity and said, hey, let's see what we can do for this. We can hire a bunch of people away from, you know, some of the existing companies to see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And there was a lot of pundits that said, this will never work out. But again, they've got plenty of money. Let them test it out. You know, let's move on to the next thing.
I think the biggest issue, you look at everything that Tesla has done and what an uphill battle it's been just to have what they have. I mean, you think about, I never realized that there were laws in so many states that prohibited car manufacturers from selling directly to the public. So you had to use dealerships. Tesla has fought and won that fight, but they've also lost it in a number of places too. You know, Apple would have never been happy strictly going through a middleman. They would want to sell directly to their customers. And that's only just the retail side of it, right? There's no way you could pivot into car manufacturing without either having to buy somebody that's already doing it or partnering with somebody that's already in this business. I mean, that you certainly couldn't do it in secret like they do with like building a phone or building a tablet or something. It would have to be a massive, massive bet to make that work. The only thing that I think is really, I don't think their self-driving system, if it's not attached to a partner, is going to work. Most of these car manufacturers want to control the experience just like Apple. And I don't see them ceding that to Apple unless they're owned by Apple.
I think to your point with Tesla, that's another reason for Apple to kind of play around with this in the background, because Tesla's done a lot of the legwork for them already. They've already jumped into that pool and have tested the waters and have gotten some changes done. And, you know, and so Apple sees some of the things that they're going to be up against. So why not give it a try? That said, instead of coming up with a self-driving car, like the whole car, why don't we work on just getting some iPads mounted in some dashboards where we have good touch interfaces and GPSs in cars instead of the crappy systems we have now? I would love for Apple to just go that route. Can we just get a true CarPlay where somebody sticks a big old iPad in the dashboard of my Acura, please?
So instead of your standard 8-inch GPS screen, navigation screen, you would have the 12.9-inch screen in the middle of the dash. It'd be like that big speedometer in the middle of the Mini.
Just AirPlay in my car would be great. So when I have Waze open or Google Maps or Apple Maps, where I could broadcast it on that bigger screen in my car, that seems so simple. So simple a concept to be able to take the GPS from my phone and put it on that dashboard. And the only thing I can think of, the reason it doesn't, is because car manufacturers charge $3,000 and up to put a GPS in your car that most people never use because they always use their phones because the maps are always more up to date.
Well, and you can do the subscribed or get the DVD updates on it too, so that you could update the map periodically. And who knows what they charge for that? I have no idea. I know that Garmin and TomTom charge $60 a year or something like that.
People will still pay a premium for that. So I don't know why, but they do.
How crazy is it that my car has a DVD player, but my computer does not?
That is kind of weird. Well, you know, that also brings up a good point, too, about the slow adoption of CarPlay. It's largely in part because these systems are designed years and years and years in advance. We had the Lightning port in, what, 2012, the end of 2012, and it's still taking a ridiculously long amount of time. When I bought my car in 2014, the optional iPod connection kit was still the 30-pin. I had to special order the Lightning cable, and it had been out for 2 years at that point. So it's that lead time that really, really sucks when it comes to people who want to be early adopters and early movers. Something that I forgot to put a link in our shared notebook, Android, it came out this week that Android's going to have an auto mode for phones now. So I guess the sentiment was, we're not really happy with the way that people are adopting Android Auto, so we're going to make the phone function in that same way. And if you have a big phone, it's in a holder, guess what? You have Android Auto. I think that is something Apple really needs to take a close look at. Make it so that we have a mode on the phones where it's more voice responsive, where, you know,
zoomed icons, yes, or something.
Yes.
Larger fonts.
As someone who owns a Plus, I would absolutely eat that up in a heartbeat. Let me turn my phone from a portrait to landscape and have it function. Well, I can already do that with an iPhone 7 Plus, but have it function in that same way, it would be a nice thing, because you're never going to get the auto manufacturers in their current incarnation to play ball. They're just not, and that really stinks.
Well, you know, turn it landscape and hitting car mode on your phone instead of having, say, a 4x5 grid of icons, you have, you know, a 2x4 right, grid exactly, of icons.
Just like something. You would with CarPlay. So I hope they do that. I don't know. I was kind of psyched by the aspect of or the idea of having access to an Apple car, but, you know, it seemed very ambitious.
I'd be perfectly happy with a Tesla.
I heard on the radio this week about Tesla, and they are taking away the free forever charging stations until the end of the year. If you buy a Tesla, you'll be grandfathered into that program, which they say comes out to roughly about $10 for a 30-minute charge. Now may be the time, Jim, but I think that's maybe how they're going to possibly pay for putting more of those supercharging stations around the U.S. possibly, and not just in Tesla-prevalent areas like California.
I hated to see them in that program, but I mean, it's realistically, if you want more, it's going to cost. Somebody's going to have to pay for it. A couple of years ago, when I got the Mercedes, I actually looked at getting a Tesla, and just going to see my family in Mississippi would have been, I wouldn't have been able to make it on a single charge. And I'm not going to stop at some city along the way. And there weren't a lot to stop and be able to charge. And of course, there's no superchargers between here and there either. But I just wasn't going to have to deal with that. And you look and they're like, it's completely possible to drive across country in a Tesla. Yeah, if you're driving from New York, you pass through Chicago, you know, if you take a very northern route, they're going to have to get better adoption on that. And the time has come, you have to pay, right? There's just no other.
You're trailering a hydrogen fuel cell behind you.
Pretty much.
I'm in the same boat as you, Brian, as far as going from Dallas to South Mississippi. If I looked into it, it's an 8 to 10 hour drive, just depending on how often I stop with the dogs. It would have been not possible, or I had to stop. And of course, I'm in the middle of Louisiana for most of the trip, where you're lucky if you can find a Burger King or a McDonald's, much less a charging station. So yeah, same thing here. With just around town, it would have been great, and for shorter trips, but still traveling around the Southeast, I think it's not something that's readily available.
So let's talk about the NES Classic Edition. We talked about it a few weeks ago. It finally got released yesterday for about 10 minutes and completely sold out. There were reports of lines of people showing up at GameStop and Target and all these places, and each one only had like 6 or 7. Amazon put it on sale yesterday at 5 p.m. Eastern. It sold out in under a minute. And when it comes down to it, when The Verge, and we'll put a link in the show notes, the Verge looked at it, it's basically a Raspberry Pi with an NES emulator running on it. So they pretty much built their machine just like us. What do you guys think of this ridiculous shortage?
I remember when I bought my Raspberry Pi 3 a few months ago, it was actually hard to get a hold of. And I don't know if that was because it was relatively new, so you could get a lot of Raspberry Pi 2s, but I wanted all the built-in features. So it makes me wonder if that could be the problem, or it could be that they're trying to go from the Pis are made in England and they've got to source them over to Japan or wherever it is that they're assembling them.
I bought 6 of them and have them on eBay for $200 and up right now. So just hate me. Just kidding. I'm sure that's where they all ended up. I bet over half of the ones that were bought yesterday in the rush will never be opened by whoever bought them, that they're going to be sold for somewhere else.
I did see a story where they're going for like $400 and higher on eBay right now for something that's 30 years old. And it's mind-blowing to me that it's like, just wait, people. This is an artificial shortage.
The craziest thing about all of this is Nintendo. I mean, they keep trying and they come out with this next thing and this next thing. And the Wii was a hit for a while, but it was still underpowered. And then that next thing they did with the big tablet that came with it, and now this next big thing where you got to plug the tablet into the base and all this crazy stuff. And then the one thing they release where everybody goes, you know, ape for it is this $60 device that plays 30-year-old games that probably cost them, what do y'all think, $10, if that, to make? maybe?
Well, if they could wholesale the parts, maybe. If you buy a Raspberry Pi, and it's probably not a Raspberry Pi 3, if you buy a Raspberry Pi 2 retail, I mean, it's $25, $30. And then you've got to think about the labor. You know, I mean, I realize they can just burn a ROM and make a billion of them if they wanted to and just slide it into the little SD slot. Surely it's got more than $10 of parts in it.
Sad thing is, it probably doesn't. And the funny thing there is that it just occurred to me that Nintendo is basically Lucasfilm at this point, where, you know, hey, the prequel trilogy may or may not do well, but hey, I'm going to re-release Star Wars every few years on DVD and people are just going to lap it up. That's what this is.
That's an awesome analog.
As we're sitting here thinking, well, they may do okay with this new tablet. The Wii did good, but, you know, the... It never approached the heights of the old days. What do they do when they need to fill up their bank account? Oh, we'll just go back to this well again, re-release it. The member berries will be strong with this one, and people will, you remember Nintendo? You remember Mario? They'll go out and buy this thing in droves, and they did. Hey, I tried, but it was already gone.
By the time my phone dinged and I touched the link that was saying, here's your reminder, I go and I get the 500 message saying, this page is not available.
I have never gotten that message on Amazon for anything in my life trying to order from Amazon, and it was down not for a minute, it was down for an hour yesterday, clear hour, where every time I checked back, that page was not available. Just so crazy. And let's not forget, we're supposed to be getting Mario for iOS, which was announced 2 months ago, right at 2 months ago now, and we haven't heard a thing about it since then. I was thinking that would land by Christmas time, but I'm not real sure now.
I was doing a software install for a potential customer from 3 yesterday until 6. So honestly, it wasn't even on my radar that this was, I forgot, honestly. And about 5:15, I was like, oh crap, wasn't that supposed to happen at 5? So quickly, I pull out my phone, load up the Amazon app, I click on that thing, and it sends me back to the main page. Like, when you would click on the item, it would reset your experience. So that was, the pent-up demand. I don't know. It just seems like it's an artificial shortage. By making so few of these, they're keeping conversation about it alive. It's going to be on tech sites. This isn't an iPhone, folks. This is something that's easily manufactured. It's not cutting-edge graphics. It's not some special GPU that had to be made by NVIDIA or AMD. This is literally the easiest thing in the world to be made with off-the-shelf components.
Well, not only that, it's something that's easily baked at home with a little open source software.
After Christmas, you'll be able to get these things at Love's truck stops.
There'll be a sign for it above the gas pump saying, now, $19.99.
Do they have those outside of the South? Do they have Love's truck stops outside of the South? Or is that just a Southern thing?
I'm assuming they have them all over the place. You have trucks everywhere. Trucks have to have truck stops. I mean, it's, you know,
saying that they don't have truck stops.
We have Bucky's in Texas, and Bucky's is like the king of stops, but they don't actually allow trucks. But Bucky's are like a super Walmart for gas station in Texas. It's a destination, if you can believe it.
Yeah, they have whenever I'm on the interstate going around Georgia, I see the Loves and those types of things. You don't really see them inside the city. It's when you get out on the interstate and you've been driving for an hour that you'll see a ton of those in any direction.
Well, just on the fringe, and the sign is 1,000 feet tall.
Yes, and they always have a Wendy's or a Taco Bell or a Subway or a McDonald's in them.
Shower stall 40 is now available.
There's probably a whole subset of folks out there that have no idea what we're talking about.
So let's talk about Spotify. So did you hear this week that Spotify was allegedly, I say allegedly because I don't know, but people are saying apparently there was a bug inside of the app that was causing gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of data to be written to people's hard drive, even when you weren't downloading music, even when you weren't doing anything. It was just sitting there and in some cases thrashing SSDs. As part of our 1%er music club, what do you guys make of that?
I've never really paid attention. You know, I've never opened Activity Monitor while I'm streaming or even downloading music inside of Spotify to really know, or opened another sort of disk thrashing utility like Black Disk or Black Magic Disk or whatever it's called. And I've never noticed any lag on my machine while I'm using Spotify, and I may be writing code or surfing or something, you know. So it's, even if it is thrashing it, it's to me, it's been unnoticeable.
I've not a Spotify user. I just read that story before we came on. Just the sheer volume of data that it was mentioning was crazy. I mean, like gigabytes over, 10 to 15 minutes just written and rewritten to your drive. That it seems like something that could have been fixed easily. I mean, like, okay, everybody's reporting this. You just fix it. But I like Brad just said, if you've got a decent hardware in your machine, you probably didn't notice it. Somebody's, just happened to look at Activity Monitor or something. And so it's probably happened to a lot more people than that are actually seeing it, right?
You would have to think. I mean, and the number of writes too, which is funny with SSDs, is that this could actually seriously shorten the lifespan of your SSD. That was kind of scary. They're saying that the bug is fixed. Spotify released a note saying whatever. I don't think they admitted that anything was wrong, but the user that some small set of sub-users have seen has already been fixed in this latest release. I went ahead and uninstalled it from my Mac. If I'm going to listen to it, more often than not, I'm going to do it from the phone anyway, so didn't need the headache on that one. I used to remember you used to be able to listen from the web. Is that still a thing, or do you have to use the app?
You still can. You have to have a Flash player. It's not HTML5 or anything like that. So if you're like me and you sort of use Safari in a walled garden, I don't put any plugins into it like Flash or Silverlight, whatever it's called. I have to open Chrome if somebody sends a link and it tries to prompt, which is not a big deal. I don't really care about that, because what I'm going to do is open it inside the web player, possibly hit save, and then I'll just swing over to the standalone player and kick it off there.
Do you have that extension in Safari that if you load something, because I'm the same as you, I typically don't load plugins into Safari because I want Safari to work the way it was intended to work. And there's a plugin you can get where it sits in your bar. And if someone sends you a link for something that requires Flash or requires something like that, you click on the button, it automatically opens that URL in Chrome so that you can use it without having to, have you seen this?
No, I haven't seen it. And I already have, at least 15 icons up in my menu bar when I'm, and all we're doing is using Skype and maybe an audio recording app. And, if I'm really busy doing several things, there'll be probably 20 or 25 icons up there. That's all I need is just one more icon up there to either take up space or make me feel crazy because it's just sitting there staring at me or whatever.
I use PopClip for that. I mean, I use PopClip for a lot of other stuff, but I've got a opening Chrome on PopClip. And so if I go to a URL and it's something that I need to open in Chrome, I can just right click on the URL and click open Chrome. And I've even got like a separate one for open regular Chrome or open Chrome incognito. So put it on, what I'm looking at.
PopClip is a very cool add-on. I just love the fact that I just select something and it prompts to copy or paste, sort of like it does on iOS. That's become such an innate thing for me.
The extension that I'm using, and I'll put a link in the show notes, is called Open in Chrome by Luke Hagen. And it's really kind of nice. Most of the time, it's something like if I forget and I want to watch Hulu and I load it up in Safari because that's my browser of choice. And, oh, wait, you don't have Flash installed. Oh, click on this button and I'm already in a show. I'm already in that show's page. It just opens up and automatically works. I own PopClip, but I forget that I own PopClip, so I guess I should have configured that. But this is a free extension and super useful. So speaking of things that require Flash in some capacity, I've always been a big fan of the PlayOn. For the Windows PC, we mentioned that from time to time about how I use it to record off Netflix and Hulu. Well, they launched their PlayOn Cloud this week. And have you guys had a chance to see this? Do you know what it is?
I got an email about it because I bought PlayOn several months ago. And I remember getting a Indiegogo or a Kickstarter email saying, please help us get this venture off the ground. And then I remember getting a follow-up email saying, hey, it's ready. Let's jump on it. And I haven't. I think I opened a trial of it and messed around with it for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, but I haven't latched on to it.
This is new to me. I'm not a PlayOn user, so I haven't used it before, so...
It is kind of neat. So if you use the product before, basically it does screencasts and record off like Hulu or the CW or Amazon Video or one of those things. But you still had to have a PC to use it, which as a Mac user, I mean, I do, but as a Mac user, it really wasn't open to you. Or if you're just sort of a mobile user, it's not really open to you. So with this, and they only launched with a subset of channels, you fire up the app, you pick what you want to watch, you hit the button, and it'll record it on their server. So it fires up an instance on their server, it records it, and automatically pushes it to your phone or iPad or whatever when it's done. And the way that they monetize it is that you buy credits. So you'll get so many recording credits, and each recording costs a credit. But they had a pretty good deal on how you could get it. And they have ad skipping technology built in. So if you, let's say you're recording something off of the CW, let's say you want to watch this week's episode of The Flash. You can record it, it'll push it to your device, and when you're watching it, it detects where the commercials are and just automatically skips over them to when it's back.
So if you were like you two guys and you travel a bit for work, you could, and you knew that you were going to miss, say, 5 shows while you were out, you could maybe buy a bundle of 5 credits before you left town.
Yep, that's exactly the way it works. Because right now what happens, if I want to pull this move now, the regular play on for the computer, for the PC, has a DVR functionality into it. So it'll automatically go and pull, you know, via RSS or however it's doing it, figure out there's a new episode, automatically record it, but I still have to get it to my device. So I usually end up having to remote into my computer, fire up Dropbox or something, move the recording to Dropbox. And then once that's synced, I can get on my phone or iPad and then pull it down over Dropbox into my program. Kind of cumbersome, but, you know, I'm actually thinking of trying this the next time that I have to travel. If I'm going to be on the road, something's out there that I want to see, I'll buy a handful of credits and just push it to my device and, you know, and not have to go through that additional step.
What are the credits cost? And do you get a discount for buying more at once?
They sent me the same emails. I got a ton of those when they were trying to fund it, so they had a deal on them. The credits are pretty inexpensive, but one credit equaling one recording is kind of interesting. So I could see myself buying 10 or 20 credits, however much that costs. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
I'm glad it's not time-based, so one credit would be 30 minutes of recording or something. It's one shot per show.
Well, I will say you need to do you probably should do the auto download to your device, because the moment you record it, you have 30 days to get it off of their cloud server into your hands, or it gets automatically deleted. But I mean, you can also download it to your PC, because when it finishes, they send you an email link. You click on the download URL if you want to, and you can download it to the PC. So you don't have to, it's not just a purely mobile solution.
So PlayOn, is that sort of grayware? Is that what they call that? Like, technically, you're not supposed to be recording from Hulu, right? And so do they exist kind of in that middle ground where we're doing it because we can, but we're really not supposed to?
Yeah, TechCrunch had a thing on that yesterday where it's sort of like, is this legal? Is this quasi-legal? And the way that they get around it is, first of all, their end-user license agreement prohibits you from distributing it or doing anything. It's only for your own personal use, and you're actually only time-shifting it. They're not doing anything behind the scenes to circumvent, you know, DRM or anything. They're doing a screencasting. If you can watch it, you can record it. Is it going to be – it's not going to be 1080p. I mean, it's 720, but even then, sometimes it looks like it's still pretty low quality depending on the provider.
Or you'll see the buffer pick up. It'll be, you know, real blurry from the first 10 seconds or something.
Yeah, until it picks up.
Okay, so it doesn't record it for you to keep. It records it for you to watch later.
There's nothing stopping you from doing that if you wanted to. But by doing so, you're breaking the end user license agreement that you agreed to when you got the software. There's no DRM in it. I mean, you get a recording, you can go and you can be like me and trim out the commercials yourself with a cheap video editor, or, you know, there's any number of ways you can do it.
Okay, so PlayOn is legal.
It's marketed as a DVR, Jim.
Yeah, so PlayOn itself is kind of legal. We're recording it for you to watch later. If you do something else with the file that we give you to watch later, that's on you, not us.
Pretty much. Honestly, that's the way it should be. If you're out distributing something, and if you have used it, you'll notice when you record things, and this is true with the cloud version too, it sticks your name, your whatever name you use when you bought the license, it sticks your IP in it. Like, there's things in there that if you're not savvy enough to go and remove them, would certainly identify you to anybody.
It's definitely watermarked. Maybe not like an iTunes file where it's stuck in the metadata, but it's definitely there at the beginning and at the end of the recording with a big black title that says, Jim Graham recorded this at this IP.
Yeah, so they definitely try to discourage it. I've used PlayOn since, like, I don't know, 2008, 2009. I've seen it go through multiple iterations, and it's usually pretty good. On the PC, I also enable the hardware acceleration and use the offloading to the GPU that you can do. I didn't even realize those options existed, because I used it for so long when my computer was not good that now that I have a good computer, I'm like, oh, wait, I might be able to make the quality better.
Yeah, I know I'd heard you mention it for quite a while, but I wasn't sure what it was. It wasn't something that I had used. But that makes more sense that it's, you know, kind of a DVR service like you described.
And the way they get around the different things is, I guess they have a sort of a plug-in API or library that they built on their own, so that this website uses Flash for its player. It allows you to put in your login credentials, and it fires up a test player, and it says, if you can see this video, check this box and hit OK, and then it saves it so that it knows. And then if there's another player that uses HTML5 or some other way to display it on the screen, it sort of automatically adjusts based on your player preferences.
Yeah, you have to have credentials to watch anything that requires a subscription. And the cloud one is still true too. The cloud has a small subset of channels right now that it will give you access to, but probably their most popular ones if I had to guess.
So you could use this for YouTube or Vevo if you wanted to.
If they added it as a channel, which right now they haven't. I think it's like the CW, HBO, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, like the big ones are in there right now.
I mean, but just play on in general is what I mean. Maybe not play on cloud, but just play on in general. You could use it to record YouTube or you know, Vevo videos, yeah. Things like that.
Very cool stuff. You've been traveling a bit, Jim. How have you been liking your Sony MDR-1000X headphones now that you've had them for a few weeks?
I couldn't be happier with the new headphones. They feel great. They're comfortable. The sound is really good. On 2 to 3 different occasions, I've been asked about them, like, hey, you know, what are those? You know, because they're, visibly different than what people have seen before. So, you know, I'm like, they're the Sonys, real similar to the Bose, you know, QC35s. But yeah, they've been great. No problems with battery life at all. These have where you charge them via the micro USB instead of having a built-in battery like the Bose do. The ability to raise your right hand to your right ear and you just cup over the headphone and it turns off, it pauses your music and it turns off the noise canceling. So if I'm wearing them in the office and I want to hear something that going on, just raise my hand up, put it over my right ear, pauses the music, and I can listen for as long as I want. Now I might look like a dummy with my hand raised to my head, but that is really neat. It's really neat technology the way that works.
That's really cool.
I definitely did not realize that was a feature. So how's the battery life when you've been on planes? How's the noise canceling held up? Has it been as good as the QC25s you owned?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had any issues with the batteries running low on me. I did a St. Louis to Seattle and then Seattle back to Dallas last weekend, and no problems on either one of those flights as far as the battery life. I think it's supposed to be 6 to 8 hours. I've used it on the plane and then all day at work on Mondays or Tuesdays without plugging into the charger and no issues. So they've got a really nice case, really nice build quality. You can tell they're a little heftier than the Bose, a little bit heavier, but I've really enjoyed them so far.
It's funny to me the amount of quality that in people's heads that put into the weight of their headphones. And I'm not faulting you, Jim, or about your headphones, but you know, there was some breakdowns a couple of years ago with the Beats headphones about how they talk about their premium and their $400, and somebody took them apart and they were just basically Radio Shack components, and they actually had like a lead weight sitting in the bottom of each earpiece to make them just feel like they were higher quality.
I think they did a breakdown, and even the Bose have a weight in them to make them a little bit weightier on your head.
Balanced.
So yeah, I wouldn't doubt that at all. I'm just from a standpoint of, these have a metal, they're metal build quality instead of some of the pieces that are on the Bose that were plastic. These are metal in those cases, or the outer shell of the headphones themselves. It's not leather, but it's got almost like a leather kind of pleather, but nice feel to it. I don't want to say pleather because that's such a negative connotation, but you know, they have a real good feel about them. Just like on the right ear where I said you could raise up your hand and turn off, pause the music. The left ear has touch spots where you can pause your music, go forward, backwards, turn up the volume or down the volume. I found those to be a lot trickier as far as finding the right place to touch if you're wearing the headphones. So I haven't really used that much because I tend to hit in the wrong spot. The volume is a little bit easier, but yeah, it's a little touchy if you're wearing the headphones and you're trying to control it via there. You know, I just kind of pick up my phone and do my controlling via the phone. And one other thing I had noticed that I saw a couple of people complaining about in the reviews, and I have not seen this. I can pair with multiple devices and it works. So I can have it paired with my iPad and my iPhone, and it'll pick up, because I know like on the plane the other day I put them on and it said paired, and I looked at my phone. I'm like, no, I've got my phone on airplane mode. And it was my iPad that was in my book bag underneath the seat that I hadn't put in airplane mode. It had picked up and connected to the headphones when I turned them on. So
my Trex Titanium do that, my little tiny cheekbone headphones do that. That's one thing I do like about those is, you know, there's one button on the left side that either answers a call or pauses and plays music. And then on the other side is volume up and down and power. Volume up and power are the same button. One's a hold and one's a click. I just wanted to say with the model name of those Sonys, the MDR-1000X, I was listening to this podcast that's been going on for a couple of weeks now. He's about to do his third episode, I think. It's a House Stuff Works podcast called Tech Stuff or something like that. Anyway, he talks about the history of Sony, and it's in parts, and he talks about Japanese culture, and he also business in Japanese culture, but he's also talking about some of the innovations that they've made over the years, building their own transistors and all that. And it's just funny to hear some of the different long model names they come out with for all these different products. So in this, you got the MDR-1000X, and then they would have this Betamax player they made in the mid 70s that had crazy long name. I don't know how, as a consumer, you would walk into a store and say, hey, I'm looking for the Sony. And then you rattle off this long string of characters, and people are like, what are you talking about? We don't have that yet.
Yeah, that's one area where Apple has done something that the rest of the industry should follow, is simplify the product names and identify it by year or revision or whatever. Because, yeah, I had to look at the show notes to remember what kind of headphones does Jim have?
Yeah, the new Sonys. That's all I would tell you. The new Sonys.
The 398s.
I remember. That's something you remember, is how much they cost you.
Yeah, I've had my eye on those for a while. A little more on the home automation. I got my first light done this week, my first lamp. It was kind of nice. I got the integration with both Siri and the Amazon Echo going. So I'm really happy about that. I can give it a command. And I was kind of like a kid. I'm like, you know, turn the light on, click, turn the light off, click, and just watch it. And I did it like 10 times.
And your dad yells from the other room saying, stop flipping that light on and off.
Yeah, apparently that wasn't the only one that I wasn't the only one that happened to as a kid. I'm using the iDevices plug for that, and it's working pretty well. So I liked it. I bought four more this week, and I'm going to go ahead and set those up in my formal living room to be able to control that in a zone.
So it's a plug that plugs into the wall, and then you plug the lamp into the plug.
Right. So I looked at some of the ones that had the integrated light socket, where half the socket was controllable through HomeKit, the other half was just a normal socket. And eventually I may end up going that route. And, you know, because the thing that I'm noticing about the home automation, when I look at the light switches and I look at the electrical outlets, these things are ugly for the most part. If you want anything that's really nice, they don't seem to make it, or at least I haven't been able to find it.
You definitely need to be able to put a piece of furniture in front of it. You know, you've got this huge wart on your wall.
Yeah, and these things also have a nightlight mode, which, you know, they're trying to make the best of it. So you can configure that to come on or off. And it looks like it's a straight white line across the thing that has a light in it that's, you know, a little LED that you can change the color on, or, you know, you don't have to use it at all. And it took me a minute to figure out that those are two separate controllable things inside a HomeKit. But yeah, I really don't like that. And I don't like, with the light switches, the ones that Elgato released. So I have the Elgato Eve. I'm going to use that on one. It's okay. I mean, it's nice. It's minimalist. I like it. It's solid white, just solid white, and looks like it's glass pretty much. And I like that a lot, but it doesn't work with Alexa. But also, these don't work a lot of times with multiple switches. So if you have light switch that controls, you know, your fan and your light independently, you either have to put two of these ugly looking things side by side. I mean, there's no multi-switch, at least as far as I could find. If I'm wrong, I would love for someone to show me where I'm not right on this. But there doesn't seem to be a lot in the way of being able, you can't use a wall plate, a face plate to go over it that fits in with the decor of your room. I mean, little things like that where if I'm just a single guy in an apartment, I wouldn't care. But, you know, you pay money, you have the walls painted, you have a decorator come in and do some of this stuff, and you don't want to mess up the investment you've made in your house. And there's not really a solution for that.
Well, you don't have Bob Marley posters on your wall. You're not 20 years old. You know, you do expect to have some level of, like you said, decorum to your home when you're 40 years old. You know, you don't want to just look like you're a college student, you know, with posters on the wall.
What do you got against Bob Marley posters?
Nothing. I love Bob Marley.
I have one of these plugs. I'm not even sure who the maker of my plug is, but I have to use this app called Casa on my phone instead of HomeKit. This is one I've had for about 6 months. So it's an app called KASA, Casa, that I use to turn the plug on and off. My apartment has track lighting in a couple areas, and it's awful because it only lights up really bright one little part of the big room. You don't get full room light. So what I did is I strung some LED rope light all the way around the top of the wall, all the way around the apartment. And so when I turn those rope lights on, it bam! I mean, it lights up the whole apartment super bright. And so I have those plugged into this Wi-Fi plug that I can just turn on and off with my phone, so I don't have to go over in the corner and, you know, hit the button or plug it in or plug it out. I also bought a cheap, like $12 fader for those lights, dimmer switch, that doesn't work great. It's more like really bright or really dim. It's hard to kind of get something set in the middle, but that was the best thing I could find on Amazon. I really wish I could find a Wi-Fi plug that had a built-in dimmer that I could control from the phone. That would be really nice if I could get that working.
Dimmable LEDs are still sort of half and half. You know, they're really good ones, and there's ones that seem to work, and then there's some that just, you know, it's either super bright or super dim. I've got a dimmable LED in my desk lamp here, just a regular old screw-in bulb, and it works pretty good, but there's still only about maybe three or four variations, even though the switch on the base just turns from 360 degrees on or off with all the variations in between. If you had a standard incandescent bulb in it, you'd have 1,000 variations in the brightness of the light. So, I mean, it's probably coming, but dimmable LEDs still aren't really there, as are dimmable compact fluorescents.
One of the craziest things I've seen with these rope lights is, so I have a little fridge that is my beer fridge. You know, it's a dorm fridge, not the half height, but, you know, it's kind of like a 3/4 height little fridge that I keep beer in. When that fridge kicks on and off, these lights will dim and then come back up. The power in the apartment is such that that fridge kicks on and you can tell it in the lights. The other thing is I have a heating pad that my two old dogs use. If I plug that heating pad in, no matter where I plug it in the apartment, it doesn't have to be in the same outlet. If the dimmer is all the way high, like 100%, I don't notice anything. But if you dim it even slightly on the switch while that heating pad is plugged in, you can visibly see the rope lights pulse. It's the craziest thing. And I thought, well, maybe it's because they were plugged in close to one another. I plugged in the heating pad on the other side of the apartment, and still it doesn't matter. If that heating pad is plugged in and you've got the dimmer on, like the dimmer actually reduced a little bit, you can see the lights pulse in the apartment. So that's kind of a pain.
I upgraded my phone to iOS 10.2 beta 2 this week, and it had some really, really bad results. It was a lost day of productivity for me as I had to downgrade it back to 10.1.1. That was how I know. I mean, we talked before the show that there was an updated version of 10.1.1, which Apple will sometimes do. They'll push out a version that's new, that's not really new, but it's newer than what they already pushed out, if that makes any sense. That's how I knew that was going on. 10.2 seemed like it was going to be fine, and all of my notifications got jacked up. I would get alerts, but I wouldn't get any previews. It was madness. Phone calls stopped passing to my watch, stopped passing to this and that. It broke everything. So I guess that's on me for going to a beta release. But usually those point releases are pretty good. But I mean, I had to redo my watch. I had to restore from a backup that was like 3 or 4 days old. It was rough stuff. Now everything's fine, but lesson learned on playing with betas.
Well, it happens, and being the risky risk takers that we are, trying out beta stuff on your production desktop, or I guess people don't really have production phones and test phones if you're just a regular consumer, but that happens to us all the time. Or if you're like Jim and you carry two phones, one for work and one personal.
That was my 6S that I still have laying around here that I haven't done anything with. So I use it for games, and I use it for a remote for the Apple TV. I've actually considered doing a clean install on my 7, because when I originally got it, I did a backup and restore to it, and I've had some glitches, and I kind of wonder if a clean install would fix those. But there's so much that I know I would lose or have to set up again. I've been avoiding it.
Strangely enough, the thing for me that I would dislike is having to re-download all of the gigs and gigs of podcasts that I have in my device, because some of those, like Mark Maron's podcast, you know, the last 6 months are free, and I get way behind on his. Some of those aren't available anymore when I if I were to flush the device and reinstall it, even though it knows which ones I've listened to and which ones I haven't, and it marks them unplayed, you still have to go back and download them. And
one of the things that I would lose that one of the games I play called Traveler's Quest, it's one of those virtual geocaching kind of games. You can buy maps or discover maps all over the country in that app. And if you restore, all the treasure you've previously found is all back on your account or anything. But any maps that you might have found that you didn't actually go dig up yet, those are all gone. So I would have to rebuy maps or rediscover those, because they don't come back when you just reinstall the app. But if you restore, the maps come back.
You can't do a restore purchase or anything like that and it comes back?
No, because it's just like pieces of the game. It's like that part just doesn't restore to your install. So like I said, your treasure that you had comes back, but your maps don't. Your maps are gone and you have to rediscover them.
That's really maddening. I can remember in the early days of the iPhone when I had Angry Birds and I would go and I would use Phone View to back up the progress out of the file system. Like you, even without jailbreaking, you could do this so that if you restored your phone, you didn't have to start, you know, you got credit for everything, or at least not credit. The game didn't acknowledge it, but at least your progress was there. You didn't have to go back and replay levels. You know, it was nice. But here we are. They've had Game Center forever. They've had CloudKit forever. Why this stuff isn't stored off device, I will never know. That there's a large, my wife plays a game like that where it's, she dropped her iPad a couple of years ago and smashed it, and that she had to start over in one of these games because the progress wasn't saved. Her account was still there, but all of the things that she did, and I Googled it, and it's like, yeah, this is a known thing, you know, here's how you get around it. And it's madness. I don't understand why game developers don't, why they do that.
I helped a neighbor probably a week or so ago with his iPad. He plays Real Racing 2 or 3 on his iPad, and it's pretty much the only thing he uses it for. And, you know, he just plays when he's watching football or whatever, just when he's got 2 minutes to kill. And it's a Game Center app. I mean, it connects to the Game Center. So, like, whenever we restored it and it opens up and it says, welcome back, whoever you are, whatever your green name is or gamer tag was, but none of his progress was there. And I have games, you know, like I do play the stupid Simpsons Tapped Out, whereas, you know, if I restored my phone or if I blew my phone away and just reinstalled the Simpsons app, all I got to do is sign into the EA single sign-on deal and it pulls it all back down. I'm right back where I was.
It's funny the weird things that keep us from doing full installs. That's the only thing that I miss if I have to do that. I can get rid of text messages. I can get rid of other things that I don't care about. But apparently game data is the one thing that you have to have back, and they still don't do it all these years in. It's nonsensical.
The other thing that's a real pain in the butt is re-logging into all the media streaming services you have, reactivating CNN, reactivating ESPN, reactivating AMC, you know, all these apps where you have to activate with your cable account, you've got to go in and do that again.
The rumor that I read is when this feature is available on tvOS, it will also be available on iOS. You know, you can sign into something on your phone, and I guess it's gonna tokenize it via iCloud or something to the point that you're not gonna have to do that on your TV. At least I noticed that when the betas were going out, one of the release notes said for both iOS and tvOS that single sign-on was supported.
There's a single sign-on panel inside of the settings app. I've seen screenshots of it on the iPad, so it's definitely,
yep,
you know, cross, yeah, platform, if you will, or cross OS.
It would be silly for them to not do it. So that's kind of why I think they're going to do it for both iOS and tvOS.
Why else bring along coding called single sign-on?
Jim, you've gotten some of your dongles in, but you didn't get a chance to take advantage of the cheapened dongles from Apple, I guess, because you'd already ordered.
I did order one cheapened dongle from Apple. It's actually the Belkin Ethernet I ordered when the prices dropped. So I did order that one. These other ones, I had already ordered cheaper AUKEY versions off Amazon. So I'm still getting cheaper than the Apple prices. But I did go ahead and order the Gigabit Ethernet adapter from Apple. But this is a hub with a VGA, so I can use that at work. Another charge cable that I can use when I buy another power block. I bought some USB 3 to USB-C, just little tip adapters, so you can plug right into your existing cable. And then this was the first one I'd bought pretty early on before I even ordered the laptop, was just a hub, just a USB-C hub to plug in more than one USB device at one port. So yeah, I've started my stack of dongles for the laptop, which should arrive this week in Dallas on Tuesday or Wednesday is when the ship shows. I won't be home until Thursday traveling for work, so I'll hopefully get it on Thursday and set it up over the Thanksgiving holiday week.
Going to do a full install, or are you going to do a restore, or what are you going to do?
I'll do a full install for all the Mac side stuff, and then I'll take my VM, my Windows VM that I use for work, and just move that VM over from the 13-inch to the 15-inch and not have to reset up Windows. So I'll have that all already set up, but on the Mac side, I'll set up everything from scratch.
How much customization do you do on your Mac so that when you're setting up new, how long does it take you normally to get that where you want it?
I'd say it's going to take me a full day, because there's all these little apps that I run, like Bartender and Alfred and Hazel and Dropbox, getting that configured right, get all the other apps installed, the Office apps installed, Mail. All that kind of stuff. I would say a good day. You know, now I have all this podcast stuff that I'm going to have to install, like the loopback and the that sort of stuff. So yeah, I'll enjoy every minute of it. There's nothing. I'm like a reformat and reinstall. It's like one of my favorite things in the world to do. So
clear out the cruft and start over every 8 months or so.
Right. I would love just doing that, because as soon as you do anything to a laptop, it's like it's not pristine anymore. And so if you wipe it and start it over from scratch, it's kind of like buying a notebook, like a fancy notebook that you really like. As soon as you write on the first page of that notebook, or you tear out one sheet of paper, that notebook is just not near as good as it was 3 seconds before that.
Playing devil's advocate, and I say this as someone who, when I got my iMac, I did the same thing. I did a full setup. In the future, when I get, let's say that I get a MacBook Pro, or I replace the one that I have from work, I wonder if I'm going to go through the same effort, since there's so many things on there that I already have the way that I want. I'd have to wonder if I would go and do something like Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner. I think actually that's the one that I've used more often than not, and just clone my existing drive, move it over to the other one, and just pave it back, and then boom, it's like everything I want's already there, since it's a bit by bit copy. You guys ever see a scenario where you would do something like that? I'm guessing not.
I have gone through in the past, and I mean, I do use backup utilities, but I have gone through in the past where I would actually go into tilde library and application support and pull out a specific plist file, just so that I've sort of got that configuration if I want to carry it over to another machine, whether I'm putting up a new machine or I'm just copying something over to a second machine that I maybe use. It's kind of like having a backup of my SSH keys and my SSH config file in my home folder.
Do you guys ever use utilities like Gemini 2 or Clean My Mac or something like that to do routine housekeeping to keep your? I mean, since
I do, I use both of those.
Nice.
I use Gemini. I've used that quite a bit.
It's funny we've never talked about that, because I use those as well, especially the Gemini 2. And because you think about with your phone, the way that it's designed is that, and even we know it's not the case. There are times you absolutely have to reinstall. The other day, I borked things up with a beta. Before I reinstalled, I did a erase all settings, hoping that would fix it. And it got it mostly back to the way it was, but it was still broken to the point that I needed a reinstall. But that, you know, beta software. Having those utilities on the Mac where you have this ability, I want to get to the point one day, this hope that I get past this nerd desire of always wanting to reformat and reinstall, being able to get my computer the way that I want it, do enough where this routine housekeeping you don't have to do. I want it to be more iOS. Like in that regard.
I think if I had the forethought to set the new Mac up exactly like I wanted, make a image at that point of it and save it, then I might be willing to use that image. But software updates so often now, things like Alfred and Hazel, that you know you're continually getting updates for those, that I don't even know if I'd want to do that. But I think that would be the only way I would do it, is if I made an image at the time I was done with setup, which is what I do with my Windows VMs, is when I get done installing
snapshot
it, you know, SQL Server and Visual Studio and Teradata and all that kind of stuff, I snapshot that VM. And if I ever want to create another one, or just blow that one away and start from scratch on another, because Windows, as we all know, suffers from the CRUD buildup much more than Macs do, at least in my opinion. Just over time, a Windows machine will inevitably get slower because of all the stuff that you install on it and then remove and change. Whereas a Mac, you see some of that, but not near as much.
I would keep I would do a carbon copy cloner or super duper from one Mac to another and not really have much hesitation about doing it. I would never do that with Windows. Never, ever. But, and I do the same thing. I snapshot VMs, Windows VMs, when I build them. But then again, so many updates come out between the time that you snapshot and the time you want to do it. You're still going to lose an inordinate amount of time as all of the updates when you restore, when you revert to that snapshot, you're going to have to patch the crap out of that thing just to get it so that it's not vulnerable to everything that's just floating around the internet. So food for thought.
Definitely. So I'll let y'all know how it goes.
Well, if you wanted to reset, I was going to say, if you wanted to reset your Mac, you could always log in as root or another administrative user, delete your user account and start over.
Delete your account.
I mean, granted, whatever system changes you made, you know, say you use different NTP servers that are built in, and that's going to be a system setting versus a user setting, but you might not get the system 100% back to factory, but it would save you from maybe reinstalling your, you know, everything in your applications folder, while you could also reset all of your settings. But there is under the uninstaller part of Clean My Mac, you can go in and either uninstall the whole app, or you can just say reset it, and it removes all of your plist files and cache and anything that it may have downloaded.
I think one of the things we need to try to keep track of on the podcast here, with me getting my new laptop and then Brad getting his, is how long it takes software to adopt the touch bar. Because I know when I install everything right off the bat, I'm probably not going to have any software besides the built-in Apple stuff that knows how to do anything with that touch bar at all.
Office 365.
Is it gonna already support it out the box? Or the
that's what I heard. You shared we didn't talk about it in last week's episode, but I believe Brad had a note.
I think it was mentioned during the broadcast that Office would support it, but I wasn't aware that it would support it right. It was going to be ready immediately when the laptop shipped.
So I just shared a link in Skype so you guys could see it. It doesn't say if it's going to be day one, but they've already announced every single thing that they're going to do. So I'd have to say that it's probably going to launch day one. Again, Microsoft's been a good partner for Apple. When they debuted the Apple Pencil last year, Microsoft was the partner on stage that said, hey, look what it does inside of PowerPoint. And, you know, they were drawing shapes and with the pencil, and it automatically transformed into an actual shape within a presentation. They definitely have announced it.
Well, just like they were right on board with the side-by-side on the iPad too, you know, on the iPad Pro.
So we know, I'd be surprised if right out of the box it doesn't work. So that'll be something for you to test. Let us know actually if 365 actually does that on the touch bar, and how much you guys actually use that. I mean, apparently you guys probably use your laptops as laptops more than I do. When I use mine, I try to tether to a regular keyboard and monitor as much as possible. One of the reasons I wasn't that enthusiastic about a new MacBook Pro for that feature alone is that I wouldn't use it just because my clamshell is closed most of the time.
Yeah, my use case is I'm home on Fridays mostly and weekends. So if I'm using my laptop, then I have it plugged into an external with an external keyboard and mouse. During the week, I may be plugged into an external monitor, but I'm still using the clamshell open, using the keyboard. That's the other thing that I'm a little bit nervous about is spending $3,000 on a laptop and then now adjusting to this new keyboard of whether I'm going to like it or not, or that big old touchpad that's on there. All that stuff is, I haven't used the Force Touch. Touchpad? So excited to try that out.
That's right. I'm excited about the new keyboard. You know, they were talked about the new scissor mechanism that they invented or innovated for the new 12-inch MacBook from 2 years ago. I'm kind of excited about the new keyboard just based on that. And they said they improved it for this.
So many people hate that keyboard that I hear talking about online, but I'm not a clicky keyboard type of person. I'm not precious about my keyboard. If it works and it's normal size, then I'm really sort of ambivalent, but I know I'm apparently in the minority. There's a lot of people who have they treat their keyboards like they do their coffee, their headphones, and their pens.
My biggest pet peeve is where I have to look at the keyboard and find the delete key or find the home or end key. That's, you know, most PC keyboards are so different between HP or Dell or whatever. And based on, you know, just the kind of work that I do where I'm, you know, I actually touch other people's computers. You go in and you got your hand on the home row, and then all of a sudden you need to hit delete, and you kind of do a swirl in the air with your finger, and you say, well, where's the delete key?
Crazily enough, I think if I had to pick my favorite keyboard on any device I own right now, I think it would be the iPad Pro keyboard case. I love typing on that case. It's an amazing experience. The keyboard feels great. I can always get my hands in the right spot. I love that little keyboard. So I'm hoping that this MacBook Pro keyboard, you know, is similar there. I know the buttons seem bigger and they have less space between them than the current MacBook Pro that I have now. So more like the external Mac keyboard that I have now.
I've always been a fan of the chiclet keys, because if you'll think back to some of the older PC laptops where the keys almost touch each other on the edges, you know, you would have a higher rate of fat fingering something if you're typing really fast.
Well, I guess that's about all I wanted to cover this week. What about you guys? Do you have anything you wanted to, for our closing points, anything that we missed?
There was a new, I think the peripheral company Razer makes a new iPad Pro keyboard. It's about $160, $170, and it has a backlit keys. It looks pretty slick. You may want to drop that into the show notes, just if folks want to look at a alternate keyboard, since Jim brought up his iPad keyboard.
Yeah, I'll link to that. I'll link to the review that is over at Mac Stories too, where they talk about it. It looks like a great keyboard. It's just...
it's pricey.
I don't know. I've already spent whatever I spent, the $150, $170, whatever I spent on the Apple keyboard that I have for it. If it had come out maybe a year ago when those were hard to find, it would be a much easier thing for me to switch. And yeah, the backlit keys are, I would much rather have that. And the review talks about the multiple angles you can have it at, which again, I would appreciate that as well. And you can't really type on it on a lap very well. It, because of the nature of it being so flippy, it's the Apple keyboard doesn't work so well for that. But Jim, you were going to say something?
Well, isn't it this one's Razer is a mechanical, right? Didn't it somehow have sort of mechanical keys built into it? Which for me, you could never use that going to a meeting with my iPad Pro. If I'm sitting there during a meeting and it's going as I type, you know, I want a silent keyboard in a meeting with my iPad, definitely. So I thought it said it was a mechanical. That doesn't mean it's a clicky mechanical, but at least recent experience, if somebody says mechanical, that equals clicky.
It's going to be louder than the fabric keys of the Apple keyboard, which you wouldn't think those would work. You wouldn't think that would be something that would make for a pleasant typing experience. All of the reviews that I read on it from tech folks that I follow were like, I don't like this. This is terrible, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I'm with Jim. It works perfectly fine.
Well, if you decide to get one and it is clicky, you could just become the office stenographer. Just take all the minutes every time that you have a meeting or a meeting to have a meeting.
That's the pre-meeting, Brad.
Ah, corporate life. Well, that's all we have for this week. So we'll be back next week. Jim will have his MacBook Pro. Brad, yours still hasn't shipped, but it's processing, right?
Yeah, it's there's five steps to those order processes, and it's on step two. I think Jim's was on step three. Mine's in purgatory or limbo or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I hope when you guys get it, you put it through its paces, give us something good to talk about. Let us know, for those who haven't bought it, what you like about it. Maybe do some benchmarking. Does this feel faster? How does it work?
I'll let you know if it's pro or not.
Exactly. Say goodbye, fellas.
Goodbye fellas.
Please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. We can be found on Twitter. I'm at Brian B. That's B-R-I-A-N-B. Jim is at Big Jim. That's B-I-G-J-I-M. And Brad is at Meester Idle. That's M-E-E-S-T-E-R-I-D-L-E. Thanks for listening, and we hope to talk to you next time.